You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are having a special hour-long conversation on an almost utterly unnoted and yet very important part of the, well, I call it war for the free world. Refugee resettlement and asylum matters and the impact that they're having on communities across this country, even the demographics of our nation. The person I turn to on these matters, who has really deeply immersed herself in them and helped the rest of us understand what's going on in a very non-transparent process, is Anne Corcoran. She is the administrator as well as the founder of Refugee Resettlement Watch. Google her, you'll find her website. She has just walked us through several aspects of this that are very troubling, but perhaps the most troubling of it to me, Anne, is something you mentioned, but talk a little bit more about it, if you will, the role the United Nations plays in determining who is a refugee and therefore essentially dictating to us who we will be accepting when we admit them.
Yeah, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the present High Commissioner, is a man named Antonio Guterres, who is the former Socialist President of Portugal and the former President of Socialist International, is the present of UNHCR, and they determine for us which refugees we should be taking. Now, they're not all Muslim refugees. They close particular camps around the world that they want to close, and the United States takes the lion's share of the refugees. We, most recently, there's been a lot of pressure about the Syrians, which we'll get to in a minute. The UNHCR has been pressuring literally the world to take in the Syrians in large numbers. And the State Department, for the most part, just accepts the recommendation from that UNHCR.
So, in other words, we're really finding that to the extent the refugees are going to be resettled, it's the United Nations who determines who is eligible for resettlement and essentially tells the State Department, you're going to take, if you take any refugees at all, these are the people that are eligible. This is a profoundly important insight into what's being done here and why we should be concerned about it. Anne Corcoran is our guest. She is the driving force behind a terrific online resource, Refugee Resettlement Watch. And Anne, about this business with the United Nations, I just want to lay out something that I think is afoot behind it. The single most important block within the United Nations, primarily because of its, well, vast wealth, oil wealth, much of it, but also because of the numbers of its members, is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And the OIC, as it's called, has its hands in an awful lot of what the UN does. It would seem to me, based on what you've said, in terms of the disproportionate care that seems to be being taken by the UN mechanism for placing refugees to give Muslims priority, that this may have something to do, if not a lot to do, with the role and influence and even dictates of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Are you seeing that?
I would say that your assessment is probably correct. We don't have the hard proof of that, except it's interesting to note that the United States takes by far the lion's share of the number of refugees that are resettled around the world, and that the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, is constantly haranguing countries such as Canada and Australia to take more refugees, which right now, frankly, are mostly Muslim refugees, and yet they are completely silent on Saudi Arabia, which takes zero refugees. Any asylum seeker who gets into Saudi Arabia is immediately deported back to where whatever horrible place they came from. Yet the UNHCR is completely silent on Saudi Arabia.
And that's, of course, including Muslims, who you would think would be treated rather more receptively by the Saudis. And just a point of clarification, obviously there are some countries that are adjacent to these war zones, and I'm thinking of Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, that are taking in large numbers of refugees from, say, Syria. But you're talking about countries outside of the immediate area who have a formal refugee resettlement process, and we take the lion's share of those.
Right. And those, the countries that you're talking about that are now getting the horrific numbers of Syrians, which, by the way, would be mostly the Muslim Syrians, the Sunni Muslim Syrians.
Well, and more to the point, opposed to the regime as well. So they may well be among the Islamists in Syria who are potentially quite a problem, both for the Syrian government, of course, but also perhaps for us.
Right. Now, those countries are, unfortunately for them, having to cope with this massive flood of asylum seekers. But for the most part, the camps are set up in those countries through the UN, and it's expected that eventually those people will return to Syria. They're not expected to permanently resettle. Whereas the resettlement program that I'm referring to for the United States or for Canada or for Australia, that's permanent resettlement. Any Syrian who comes here now this year is here for life. Even if the whole Syrian controversy should end next month, they are now here for life, which is a total different approach to be in a UN camp on the border of Syria and expected to go home at some point in time.
And as you said, and they are almost certainly going to find it possible to bring their extended families here as well, permanently.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That chain migration begins. It's called family reunification, and it begins, and the contractors that we just discussed in the, earlier will do the applications to bring the extended family members to join the seed community wherever it's been planted in America.
Let me ask you just another process question here. When you mentioned earlier that these contractors and subcontractors, by the hundreds evidently, compete to get these refugees, they're paid by the head, as you say, so there's obviously an incentive. How do they compete? What's the nature of that competition?
Well, they have to. They do have to submit information on how well they've done in resettling refugees to the State Department. In other words, they have to come up with figures for self-sufficiency, like how many refugees they got to self-sufficiency, which is really quite a joke because they can still be on almost all forms of American welfare and still be declared self-sufficient. So to some degree, the State Department is weighing the various agencies on how well they're doing with the previous batch. And the State Department does, honestly, in a few cases, as I've seen them shut down agencies that were doing a lousy job. I think that was part of what was going on here in Washington County in my first experience with this.
Because the community raised hell about it, though. Let's be clear. It seems unlikely that they would have been penalized, let alone shut down. But, and this is a really interesting point. How could it possibly be that you can be considered self-sufficient if, in fact, you are dependent upon the state for welfare or Social Security or, you know, the Medicare program or education or what have you, that these communities and obviously the taxpayers in these communities are on the tab for?
To me, this is the greatest failing of this program and the flaw in the program that makes them extremely vulnerable. We spend about $1 billion a year to bring in around 70,000 refugees, if you think about that, in terms of just getting them into the country, the contracts with the State Department through the Office of Refugee Resettlement and the screening through Homeland Security, which there is screening for the refugees we bring in. But nobody ever is calculating the cost on the communities, which are enormous, which is why we're getting to the point, hopefully we'll get to talk about it further, we're getting to the point where there are communities that are fighting back. The Office of Refugee Resettlement calls them pockets of resistance. And it's over this whole issue of the enormous cost to the community. A refugee, like a man with a family of six, is making minimum wage. You know he's not self-sufficient. His family's not self-sufficient. They need Medicare. They need the local school system. They need even the translation services, which are really impacting on certain cities, where a translator is supposed to be provided for just about every problem a refugee might have with government. So it's these enormous local costs that are really, really weighing this program down.
The costs, of course, reflect themselves in lots of different ways, and we'll talk more about how that's manifesting itself in our country with Ann Corcoran right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.